You're listening to the Christian Humanist Radio Network, christianhumanist.org.
This land is your land, and this land is my land, from the California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the City of Man podcast. My name is Coyle Neal. I'm an associate professor of public service at the College of the Ozarks. Joining me today on the show once again is Nathan Gilmore, the Thomas Paine of the Christian Humanist Radio Network, and English teacher at North Gwinnett High School. Nathan, how are you?
But sorely lacking common sense, strangely enough.
Well, we all know you're going to end up in a French prison at some point. That's
Yeah, again.
Although I think it is a fair question. Which of the founding fathers do you think you are?
Oh, goodness, I honestly don't think about this very often. I mean, of the founding fathers that I'm familiar with at all, I've probably got the most in common politically and philosophically with Ben Franklin.
Okay, that's fair.
Although I'm, you know, obviously more of a churchman than Franklin was. But, you know, that sort of Philadelphia preference for diplomacy over warfare tends to characterize my way in the world. How about you, Coyle?
I'm a John Adams, obviously.
Okay,
again,
very good,
more of a churchman, but as his own wife described him, he is crotchety and petulant, and I think that probably captures me fairly well.
And I'll go ahead and say that my marital habits are not Ben Franklin's either.
Right. No, there are obviously issues no matter who you pick there. So, Nathan, what's going on around the network?
So, Christian Humanist Profiles is getting back on a roll. In fact, this afternoon, after we record City of Man, I am recording an interview with New Testament scholar Bruce Chilton on his book, Aramaic Jesus. It's going to be one of our very technical, very nerdy biblical studies episodes, so I'm looking forward to that. I've also got 8 more interviews that I am in the process of scheduling or attempting to schedule. So, the second half of 2026 should see a goodly number of book interviews on Christian Humanist Profiles. There's also a recent episode of the Before They Were Live podcast that will be worth checking out. And I'm trying to think, I think those 3 shows are the ones that are still recording new episodes on the Christian Humanist Radio Network. So anything else around the internet that bears some mention, Coyle?
No, not that I'm aware of. I mean, there's a lot on the internet. It's a big place.
Well, yeah, but that bears some mention.
Right. Not that I am aware of at this time.
Very good. Very good. Well, today's episode, and listeners, you should be receiving it, you know, in the second half of the month of June, which means it is just before the beginning of July, which will mean that it is the 250th anniversary of the Declaration of Independence. So we figured we should do an episode on it. And Coyle, one of the things that, you know, in my own teaching and in my own research that has changed dramatically in the last 3 years is that as I've moved over to the high school world, in the 23 years that I taught college, I taught exactly 1 semester of American literature. And now it is the preponderance of my teaching load in high school. So I have kind of been on a quest to fill in a lot of gaps in my own education. So one of the things that has fascinated me about the Declaration is that I really didn't have a notion of how this document actually did its work in 1776. So take me back historically to late 1776. Let's assume that it takes a few months to go from, you know, the East Coast of America out to newspapers along the Eastern Seaboard and to the, you know, various publications of Europe. If I'm reading one of the periodicals in France or Scotland or the Netherlands, and I see a piece that later generations will call the American Declaration of Independence, is this something that I've seen before, just from other countries, other places? What common ground would it share with a satire by Voltaire or a treatise by David Hume? And what would be new if I'm seeing this in a European publication?
Yeah, so If you are a European or an American colonist and you're educated, you're going to see a lot of familiar echoes running through this document, and we'll talk more about this kind of later in the show. But you're gonna hear echoes of Voltaire, not many, but a few echoes of Voltaire. Certainly more of David Hume, and then if you're familiar with the English legal tradition, you're going to have heard of most of it before, because the list of grievances is sort of a list of English common law rights, so you're going to have heard all of that. What's new about this piece, though? So, yeah, there's echoes of major streams of philosophy and thought rattling around in it. What's new about it is that it's sort of a composite of so many different things brought together, as with the colonies themselves, right? It's not one tradition or one thing that you're jumping onto, even though there is the primary English tradition behind it. What's new and what's unique is this sort of cosmopolitan feel that the document is going to have. It is going to make sense to someone living in France or someone living in Spain, or 20 years later, someone living in Central or South America. This document will be very influential on the independence movement in South America when Simón Bolívar starts his thing down there. He's using us as a model. Does that make sense?
Yeah, on that same front, I mean, would this have been something that had precedence as far as a territory declaring that it is now a nation? Or is this something that's happening for the first time with the United States Declaration of Independence?
So I don't know if there is a document like this. I'm not historically informed enough to be able to answer that. There are precedents, and the one that jumps immediately to mind is the Netherlands declaring their independence from Spain during the Reformation,
okay.
Right at the tail end of the Reformation. Yeah. I don't know if there's a Dutch Declaration of Independence that they signed, or if there's some equivalent of that. I don't know. I would assume that as the Holy Roman Empire breaks apart, there's going to be some of that going on as well. Of course, the Irish are always trying to declare their independence from England. So yes, I don't know if there's a specific document, but there are certainly moments when you have independence movements. Anytime a nation gets big enough, you're going to have some of them.
That makes some good sense. I actually hadn't thought about the Holy Roman Empire, but certainly the Netherlands, you know, breaking off from Spain. In fact, I mean, you know, that's why they're the Netherlands. They're the low country of the Spanish Empire, right?
Right. Right.
So, yeah, I mean, that part is interesting to me. What's also interesting to me is if we can swing across the Atlantic to Charleston or Savannah or Boston, if someone is living in one of those places and picks up a newspaper and sees the Declaration of Independence printed there, is the average reader going to say something like, well, yeah, we're independent? Or is the average reader going to say something more like, say what? We're what?
Yeah. Oh. So yes, I mean, at this point, the tension with England has been going on for a decade, right, since the end of the French and Indian War. So the idea of independence is not new. The Continental Congress has been debating this for a couple of years at this point. In fact, they've had to sort of table the debate so that congressmen could go back to their colony and get permission to vote for independence, because some of them hadn't done that. So this has been an ongoing discussion. There's no surprises in this. In terms of whether they would recognize themselves as the United States, again, yes, but it's a new thing, right? Up until very recently, they're all loyal English subjects. Now there's this idea that maybe we need to be something different. And obviously, in someone who's teaching American literature, you're going to know more about this than I do. That hangs around even after the Revolution, right? What does it mean to be an American? What's different? Aren't we just Englishmen on the other side of the Atlantic? Well, maybe we need something else. Maybe we need our own body of literature. Maybe we need our a Washington Irving and a Nathaniel Hawthorne to come along and write stories for us that are different from what they're reading back in England. That takes a while. It's a while before we are culturally Americans as well as just politically Americans.
That makes some good sense. So as far as this goes, I mean, the shooting has already started. Lexington and Concord, which are the two battles that I was taught when I was in high school 300 years ago, you know, which is difficult since this is only 250, but you get the idea.
Sure.
You know, those have already happened. As far as significant British forces, well, how significant are the British forces on the continent by this point when the declaration is published?
I mean, we're getting our butts kicked, right? It's
okay. All right. Yeah.
This is military, and I'm no military historian. We could get Jordan Poss on and have him talk about this at some point. But this war, the question of is George Washington a good general is really an interesting one, because he loses the vast majority of the battles that he fights.
Right.
Now, he wins the war, and then you have to kind of ask, well, what matters more, winning the battles or winning the war? And we're not going to solve that debate. But yeah, the British are here. They're here in force. They're kicking our can all over the place. And
right. Yeah. And the take on Washington that I found most interesting, and I can't remember where I read it, is that when it comes to winning, you know, particular named battles, his record is terrible, but he could regroup his troops and fight another battle faster than most of the people in his generation.
Well, and yeah, so again, this starts to get out of my wheelhouse. I've heard things like, you know, every British soldier that gets killed, it costs a phenomenal amount of money to recruit and train and equip and ship over the Atlantic another one. And even if you translate it into today's terms, you're talking millions of dollars per British soldier. Every colonial that gets killed, there's another one just next door, right?
Okay.
It's not hard to replace them.
So it's something like I read about the Punic Wars, where, you know, the Romans, you know, get their cam kicked.
But they
just keep putting Romans on the field. So
right, there's always more Romans. You can't kill enough of them to. Right. It's not at that point in their history.
It's
interesting. The other thing that I've not confirmed this, but I've heard it and teach it to my students, which is probably irresponsible. But the other thing I've heard is that Washington is sort of the personal hero of Ho Chi Minh. So you have this kind of interesting,
okay.
Yeah, this interesting connection between these two American wars that, again, I've not confirmed it. I hope it's true because it makes a great story if it is.
Oh, sure,
sure. We're perhaps wandering from the Declaration. Now, Nathan, you teach this more often than I do as a literature teacher.
I do. And, you know, this is something I have taught this document all three of the years that I've taught high school. And one of the things that I do every time I teach to my high school students is before we get to the Declaration, I teach them some rhetorical structure first so that they can examine it as a piece of rhetoric. So if you are familiar with, you know, Aristotelian rhetoric, you're familiar with the terms major premise and minor premise. If you know Stephen Toulmin's rhetoric, you know the terms claim and warrant. I'm going to use Aristotle's terms here, but the major premise is that, well, I mean, it's all the business at the beginning of the document about all men being created equal, that the formation of governments is to protect the rights of those men, and so on and so forth. The minor premises are the complaints, I forget what term that you used earlier, a coil, but the complaints against the crown. Yes, the redresses. And then the declaration part of the declaration, which is the very end of the document, is the claim or the conclusion. Now, I mean, would the folks, again, reading it in those early newspapers have recognized that rhetorical structure? Is that something that latter-day rhetoric teachers have mapped onto the document, do you think?
That I honestly don't know. The people who were writing it were super smart, and they uh-huh. would have all had some kind of rhetorical training. I will admit I am not rhetorically trained, as, you know,
okay,
longtime
all right,
listeners
all
right. of this podcast are certainly aware. So I recognize bits and pieces of the concepts that you mentioned, but that's outside of my wheelhouse. But
okay, that's fair enough.
They certainly, the attorneys in there would have had some rhetorical training. The people who'd gone to college would have had some rhetorical training. People who'd gone through the various grammar schools and Latin schools that existed around the colonies would have had some rhetorical training, but I don't know the specifics of it.
That's fair enough. So, you know, just to talk about a little bit of what I teach when I teach it, you know, like I said, the major premise is what is true categorically or universally. So, you know, the beginning of the document lays out what is the nature of rights, and we'll talk about that here at some greater length here in a little bit, I imagine, and then talks about, you know, the relationship between a political community and those rights, which is to say everyone in that political community has been granted them not by positive law, but by divine law, to use, you know, some terms that Aristotle would have recognized, Cicero would have recognized. And then, you know, like I said, the minor premises, the redresses, those are recognizable, like Coyle said earlier, from specifically Anglo-Saxon and later English, you know, versions of common law rights. And then, like I said, the conclusion is what follows logically if the major premise is true and the minor premises are true. And in this case, part of the major premise is that people who are being governed in ways that violate rather than protect rights have an obligation politically to overthrow the government that is not protecting those rights and to establish a government that will protect the rights. So the therefore at the end of the declaration is, because these things hold and because these things are verifiable in the case of the minor premises, therefore the 13 states of the North American continent hereby, you know, declare that they are now a nation in the same way that the United Kingdom and France and Spain are nations. So they are no longer colonies of the crown, but they are a nation in their own right.
How does it hold up as a piece of rhetoric compared to some of the other stuff you teach?
You know, honestly, I use it as the model early on, and then that way I can refer back to it over the course of the rest of the school year. Because one of the things that I try to teach them is to think about their own writing, and especially their research writing, in terms of, I use Toulmin's terminology, so in terms of claim and warrant and evidence. Again, Aristotle would call them major premise, minor premise, and conclusion. But they're the same structures, right? So the nice thing is, later on when I'm teaching them research writing, one of the things that I can do is I can ask them about a given source. Is this a warrant source? Is this talking about what things are true in this kind of case? Or is this an evidence source? Is this what is true in this particular case? And, you know, that way I can get them to think intentionally about where it is that they locate different parts of their own argument. And, of course, the way that the Declaration of Independence arranges things is it leads with that major premise, it follows with the minor premise, and then goes to the conclusion. So it is structured less like a research article in a, you know, university press journal, because they usually lead with the claim and then get to the evidence and the warrant. And it's structured more like a classical enthymeme. So, you know, one of the things that I'm able to teach my own students is precisely the flexibility that's inherent in these structures. If you know what these structures do, and you know that you can arrange them based on your purpose, then you don't have to follow a formula when you write. You can be deliberate about what your reader needs and how you're going to meet those needs for your reader. So it really is a handy piece of writing for teaching writing.
Fair enough. Like I said, this you teach this way more than I do, so this is fascinating.
Fair enough. Well, Coyle, I do want to talk about rights. So I have read, and again, I'm not a historian. I dabble. I fart around. But I've read that medieval notions of rights tended to link rights to particular roles in a community. So kings would have the right to levy a tax. Knights would have the right to maintain arms and to maintain a fighting force. With the invention of universities, professors would have the rights to teach and to lecture as their guild deemed fit. Priests would have the right to administer the sacraments, and so on. So in our 21st century context, a lot of our disputes, especially in political realms, but in other places as well, seem to be up for grabs every time a political disagreement happens. So libertarians, broadly speaking, focus on negative rights, so zones of non-interference from national governments. Progressives tend to expand the notion of rights so that they might include medical care or college education or other sorts of things, and the costs that those incur. As far as you can tell, Coyle, what does Jefferson mean? What does he have in mind when he says that governments exist to secure and protect rights? What are they securing and protecting?
Yeah, so that's a complex question, not because of Jefferson, but because this is a composite document worked on by a committee.
And you caught both me slipping.
The old musical, 1776.
Yes.
They do a fantastic version of Adams trying to get people to write this document. And then finally, so that song, as far as I'm concerned, is the best song in the whole thing.
I love 1776.
Oh, see, I think it's not a great musical, but that song does pretty well. That,
oh, it's so clever, though.
It is that, and then the opening song. Those two. I mean, John Adams owns that musical. But if we just had Jefferson's document, right, the original draft, at least as far as we can tell, the three rights are life, liberty, and property, and those are. Those are rights that do not exist in a vacuum. They're not universal. They're not, you know, substitutes for just you can do whatever you want or the government can do whatever you want it to do. They are discrete things. So life is the government can't just kill you for no reason. They have to put you on trial, find you guilty of a crime, jury of your peers, all of that. Liberty, same thing. The government can't just chuck you into prison because you said something mean about the king or because you're in the other political party or whatever. And then property, the government can't just take your stuff away because they want it. Again, you have to have committed the crime. There has to be due process and so on. Those are the classical English liberal rights. Mm-hmm. They're articulated by John Locke, but he didn't invent them either. He's also dipping into this same sort of English common law. Well, where things get messy, the two places that gets sort of complicated, first, those are the rights that are mentioned, but they're obviously not the only rights in the document. Again, that long list of grievances are, you can imply rights out of that left and right. Things like the king has taxed us without our consent. Well, the implication is that representation is a right. You have a right to have someone standing up for you in parliament speaking that you have voted for or against. You've voted for that seat. That's that's a reasonable implication of that document, that there's some kind of right baked into that that's beyond life, liberty, or property. That's one place it gets kind of wonky. The other place, of course, is that property gets dropped out, allegedly by Ben Franklin, because he didn't want the Declaration to sound like it was defending slavery. So he drops out property and puts in pursuit of happiness, which, of course, what on earth is pursuit of happiness? Well, it's a mystery and nobody knows. How I can understand the government can't steal my stuff. I get that. How can the government steal my pursuit of happiness? I don't know. I mean, they're apparently pretty good at it because everyone's miserable all the time now. But I don't know. Like, there's no long tradition of, you know, case law behind that or parliamentary actions or whatever. Like, it's a rhetorical flourish that means we all remember that part of it because it's a great rhetorical flourish. But that's where we start to get into, well, what does this mean? Does it have any substance? Does it practically imply anything for what government does or doesn't do? Is our own government violating it? Well, I don't know because I don't know what it means. So,
well, it's interesting because, I mean, starting with, maybe not starting with, but memorably with Franklin Delano Roosevelt, I mean, it seems like that notion of pursuit of happiness becomes far more expansive and, you know, the public case for a much more pervasive government presence in the life of people seems to be made on the grounds of that pursuit of happiness. Because, I mean, it's certainly not life, liberty, or property that, you know, the is it four freedoms or five freedoms? I should have written this
four,
down.
The four freedoms.
That's right, the four freedoms.
I don't remember what they are, but I remember that there are four
either.
Of them.
Yeah, so, I mean, you know, it's interesting because, I mean, I think you're right that, I mean, in the jurisprudential realm, pursuit of happiness doesn't mean much, but in the deliberative political realm, it seems to have expanded substantially within the last 100 years.
Well, and certainly the rhetoric, I mean, the politicians use this, not just Roosevelt, everybody uses this, right? You are free to pursue happiness when the government stays off your back, or you are free to pursue happiness when the government gets involved. And again, I don't know, in part because of the way it's added in, I don't know what we're supposed to do with that.
That's
what do you
enough.
Do with it when you teach, right?
Well, I mean, one of the things that I always ask is, and I usually do this as an exercise at the beginning of class, is certainly you've, you know, heard somebody talk about the rights to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, and I just have them write a few sentences about what is a right. And one of the things that one of my purposes there is not to have them remember what somebody has taught them about what a right is, but for them to realize that no one has ever taught them what a right is. And like I said, the interesting thing for me is that when I read language about rights in medieval texts, it's almost always connected to some particular social role, right? It's the rights of clergy, it's the rights of kings, it's the rights of gentry, so on and so forth. I mean, by the time you get to the Declaration of Independence, and again, I think you're right that, you know, this document is not inventing this, but the notion of rights as extended to all people is something that, you know, it seems very different from what I see in medieval writing.
Well, and I'm not familiar enough with medieval writing. No, I do think that this has the advantage, like much of what Ben Franklin wrote, has the advantage of being sort of universally agreeable. Like,
yes,
as you say you have the right to pursue happiness, no one's going to disagree with you.
No, you don't.
No, you...
Yeah.
No, you can't try to be happy.
Right. That makes good sense.
So
it's
a
interesting.
Great moment.
And I can't remember. Oh goodness, where did I read a recent discussion of this? It was actually in another book that I'm interviewing the author for profiles. But you know, it was talking about the metamorphosis in rights languages that happens, you know, as the absolute monarchies start to expand in Europe. And,
yeah,
you know, I mean, that's when the power becomes concentrated in the crown. And I would say, not coincidentally, that's also when rights language starts to expand beyond particular roles to people in general, because the most important distinction becomes the king and everyone else, rather than, you know, between the university and the church and the king,
right,
and the so on and so forth. So,
well, and this is where our English tradition is unique, right? And again, I don't, maybe there are other places in Europe that map onto ours, but as the power in France is concentrating in the hands of the king, right, then development In England, when power begins to concentrate in the hands of the king, they chop the king's head off, get rid of the monarchy. So the trajectory is different. Absolutism never really takes hold. And that has to mean something for the development of rights also. You no longer have either a champion in the absolute monarch defending your rights, or an enemy in the absolute monarch stealing your rights. And this amorphous, sometimes the king is on your side and sometimes he's not, but also parliament is what matters anyway, which is an interesting feature of the Declaration, right? Most of the things that are listed, you know, the king has done X terrible thing, they're all acts of parliament, not really.
Yes.
It's not like King George is sitting around dreaming up some of this stuff. I mean, he's still involved. It's still a much more involved monarch than Charles III is today. But really, parliament is the villain. Parliament is the real bad guy, but I don't think they're even mentioned. I'd have to go back and read it again.
I don't believe they are, and rhetorically that's interesting because, I mean, my best theory for that, and I mean, if you've got another theory, I'd be glad to hear it. My theory for that is that even at this early stage of things, the drafters of the Declaration of Independence have a notion that if this thing goes well, they are still going to have some kind of dealings with parliament. Whereas, you know, if they just talk bad about King George, once he's dead, you know, they can say, oh yeah, the Declaration of Independence, we were just talking about that George III guy.
Right.
We didn't have Parliament in mind.
Yeah, or they wanted a seat in Parliament. I mean, if it was about representation to start with, you don't trash the place that you want to be a part of. Modern American elections notwithstanding. I genuinely don't know. It's just always struck me as odd that the king is the big bad guy, maybe just because it's one person that you can focus on. But For whatever reason, he's the one who takes the brunt of the document.
And the representation part, I just want to dwell on that for a moment, because, you know, one thing that I learned recently, like I said, it was very particular to the Glorious Revolution of 1688, and that was something that was instituted precisely as a countermeasure against the Jameses and the Charleses.
Heard that.
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, and I can't remember which document from the Glorious Revolution was at play, but when the Declaration of Independence makes mention of representation during the grievances, that is something that, at least in England, and probably folks who are familiar with international law, would recognize as something that was instituted really only a couple generations before the Declaration of Independence. So this isn't something that is an abstract ideal the way that the rights to life, liberty, and property are, but it's something that has a definite legal precedent in the documents of the Glorious Revolution.
Well, so I don't know the English, what's going on in England. I know in the colonies, so representation from the very beginning is central to taxation. So the general model, there were times this was violated, but the general model, when England wanted a tax from the colonies, what they would do is they would go to the colonial legislature and they would say, or to the royal governor, who would then go to the colonial legislature, and they would say, hey, you owe X number of pounds in taxes. Get those and send them back to the mother country. And then the colonial legislature would figure out how to collect the tax. So there is still a representative process in play. From the perspective of the colonist, I'm paying taxes to this guy that I voted for, and that's been the case since the beginning of the colonies in the early 1600s. After the French and Indian War, for the first time, the British government directly taxes individual colonists. Now, I don't know if in England, if you were the British government and you wanted to collect a tax from Liverpool, would you directly tax the British subjects there, or would you go to the government of Liverpool and say, hey, collect this? I don't know.
I'm not sure about the machinery there. What I do know is that one of the documents from the Glorious Revolution was specifically directed at James II, who violated that practice. And the document of the Glorious Revolution actually put that into written law in ways that, you know, it might have been a custom, it might have been a norm, to use the more recent term before that. But by the time the Declaration of Independence is published, it is something that is definitely in written English law, even beyond. And I mean, I think you and I have talked about this before, Coyle. If not, then this will be new for our listeners. But that's one of the things that I'm still not smart enough to figure out. When the Brits say that this or that causes a constitutional crisis, you know, my first question is, well, which article of the Constitution? And the answer is, well, there's not a written document that's violating. And I'm thinking, how can you have a crisis if there's no document then?
It's just not very American.
Yeah, no, it's...
I share the same befuddlement. I don't want to say frustration because it's not my government. But yeah, I've been loosely following the election going on in England this week, actually. So I guess it'll be over by the time this drops.
But all right.
Like the entire future of their current prime minister resides on this one tiny town of something like 70,000 people who will decide.
Okay.
And I mean, I understand that we have our own federal system and local governments affect things all the time, but that's still a fascinating system to me that I do not understand.
And I mean, what I'm thinking of is just the sheer number of times during Brexit, I'll put it that way, because Brexit took, what, about 8 years to happen?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it was a long...
people would say, this is a constitutional crisis, and I would think, okay, how can you have one of those?
Well,
that just shows how American I am. Now, Coyle, there's a specific part of the Declaration that I do want to focus on here. When I first discovered as a college student that Jefferson's first draft of the Declaration had clauses decrying the Atlantic slave trade, I assumed, as a good Midwestern lad from Indiana, that those rotten Southerners must have pressed to have them removed. But then, eventually, I got around to actually reading that part of the first draft, and I saw these words. And I'm going to quote it at length because it is, I mean, to quote Ed Stong, and I think he'd approve of this, it's crazy town. So here's the passage. He has waged cruel war against human nature itself, violating its most sacred rights of life and liberty in the persons of a distant people who never offended him, captivating and carrying them into slavery in another hemisphere, or to incur miserable death in their transportation thither. This piratical warfare, the opprobrium of infidel powers, is the warfare of the Christian King of Great Britain, determined to keep open a market where men should be bought and sold. He has prostituted his negative for suppressing every legislative attempt to prohibit or to restrain this execrable commerce, and that this assemblage of horrors might want no fact of distinguished dye, he is now exciting those very people to rise in arms among us and to purchase that liberty of which he has deprived them, and murdering the people upon whom he has also obtruded them, thus paying off former crimes committed against the liberties of one people with crimes which he urges them to commit against the lives of another. That's the end of the passage. So here's what I'm seeing in that passage, and I'll try to put that passage in the show notes because, like I said, it is a crazy little piece of text. So this version of the Declaration seems to be claiming that the king started the slave trade, the king is imposing it on the enslaved people, and on the white colonists of North America. The same king has kept those slave markets open, even though the good people of the American colonies wanted to end it over and over again. And now that same king is encouraging those enslaved black people to kill their white American oppressors, even though he started all of this in the first place. Now, Coyle, here's my question. Did anyone other than Thomas Jefferson, First Draft Thomas, ever attempt to blame the entire generations-long crime of the slave trade on one person? Or was that just a brief and happily cut fever dream of Thomas Jefferson?
I mean, boy, that version makes me feel a lot better. I prefer that to the historical reality.
Here's
this awful King George, and he did all of it.
Yeah.
I am not aware of anyone else trying to come up with a mono cause with a single supervillain who did the whole thing. I mean, this is Thanos levels of evil coming from the King of England.
It really is. You know, now that I've actually read the text of it, I'm kind of glad it was cut out would anyone in Europe have taken that seriously?
No, and no one in the colonies would have taken it seriously.
Okay, all right.
No, they all knew that's not what happened. That's not how it happened. Slavery had been around a lot longer than George the Third.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just nonsense, and they all would have known it. I think that the best, so one of the questions that I do have my students wrestle with is the Declaration a racist document? Of course you have the passages about the hordes of savages being unleashed. That does make it into the final document where the king allegedly paying Native Americans to come in and attack the colonists. But there's also the implication of, hey, this is a document.
Hold up. I want to pause just a second.
You say
allegedly. I mean, were there allies of the crown among the tribes?
Well, certainly, but that's not the same thing as saying he's paying them to massacre colonists, right?
That distinction makes sense. Keep rolling. Right. I apologize.
French and Indian War, different situation entirely. But that's one part of it. Then the other part, of course, is we have this document writing about political freedom and rights and universal rights and human rights that is written by people who own slaves, who are well aware of the disconnect there. And I think probably the best that you can say is I am not aware of any American founder who thought that slavery was a good thing. I'm not aware of anyone prior to the 19th century. They might exist because there's a lot of people, but I'm not aware of anyone who says slavery is a good thing and we're glad it's here. To the best of my knowledge, all of them hated it. All of them wanted it to go away. None of them really saw how that could happen. None of them saw a clear path forward to that. So that's, again, it's not a satisfying conclusion, but that's sort of where we are in the document.
So let me ask you this, because, I mean, two dynamics seem to be at play here. One of them is the, for lack of a better term, the Yankee abhorrence of slavery. And I'm thinking about the John Adams and the Ben Franklin side of things.
Yep.
And you have a lot of people saying, well, I mean, we would get rid of it, except that those, you know, plantation lords in South Carolina want to keep it. Were the plantation lords not publishing anything in the 18th century, or...
Even the plantation lords say this is not good. They say this is not sustainable in the long.
Okay.
Jefferson himself, right, says, "Look, I don't
but
like
that's
this.
Virginia.
This
I'm
is
talking
wrong.
About the Carolinas.
I know less about them.
Okay.
What is Charles Rutledge doing?
About. Listeners, if any of you know of any documents coming out of the Carolinas, because I know of a lot of 1820s, 1830s documents that will defend slavery in, you know,
so that,
horrifying
that changes,
positive terms. Yeah.
That changes in the early part of the 19th century. There's some technological changes. Prior to that, the best defense, well, it's not even a defense. Even the people that I know of who own slaves, who try to put a positive spin on it, it's like Jonathan Edwards up in Massachusetts owned a slave. And he said, well, I'm gonna make this guy a theologian. Like super educate him. And then when he is finally liberated, there was kind of an assumption that he would be freed at some point. He'll be ready to live like the rest of us. But that's the best that I'm aware of. And even then, Edwards didn't think it was great.
Yeah. And it's interesting because, you know, the slave codes of the 19th century, you know, are what I always think about when I think about, you know, the Atlantic slave trade. But I think you do well to note that the timeline is complicated in that respect, because those slave codes take their written form, at least, after the establishment of state constitutions. So,
well, and the cotton gin just changes the nature of slavery.
Sure.
Technology ruins everything, I say on my podcast recorded over the internet.
Yes, indeed. Yeah, and you know, as you often mention to me, you know, edited with AI tools, because I'm not that great at editing by hand. So
there you go.
So yeah, that is a fascinating bit of the first draft that I'm glad got cut out, because as we discussed, it never would have been taken seriously. And also it would be harder for us to take this document seriously, even with the difficulties that you mentioned. So let me ask you this, Coyle. I mean, you say that you haven't taught this much, but you've got a pretty good working familiarity with it. When this document does make an appearance in your political science classes or your history classes that you're going to be teaching at College of the Ozarks, what approach to it do you take, or what approach to it do you plan to take? My approach is mainly a rhetorical approach. What kinds of things have you focused on? What kinds of things will you focus on?
Yeah, so I actually might steal some of your approach to it. I've appreciated
awesome.
What you've said, and I may have to go back and crib from that. I use the document. So one of the questions I ask my students is, you know, what would it take to get you to overthrow the government? Right. If I were to say, hey, let's all go get our guns and let's go down to City Hall and let's torch the place and put something else in where it used to be, what is your response going to be? And of course the response is no. Like, no, why would I do that? There's something unusual about revolution, right? It's an unusual state of affairs. It is not a common thing. There has to be something sort of out there in the atmosphere. So I use the Declaration as this is where you can see examples of all of the ideas floating around, kind of brought together in one place. And the Big Four, if our listeners care, the Big Four, kind of in ascending order of importance. Scott's Enlightenment thought, the idea that we come to truth by having a conversation. If you want to know what the right tax rate is, you put a bunch of people in the room with differing visions of, you know, all taxation is theft, or some Marxist who says taxation should be 100%, or a, you know, reasonable person who says, well, 5 to 10%. You put all those people in a room together, and whatever they settle on, whatever they argue and discuss and talk about, whatever they come up with is the right answer. Right, that's the truth, the true answer. Well, in this case, the colonists have been cut out of the conversation. They've been blocked out of it. So it's now time for revolution. That's one that Scott's Enlightenment thought. Number two again in ascending order of importance, a Whig constitutionalism. If we want to just call that conservatism, that's fine. It's kind of anachronistic, but we can do that. So English law and English tradition has been violated. The government has broken the rules. Well, now it's time for revolution. Number three would be English liberalism.
Mm-hmm.
Again, we have these rights, that sort of Lockean rights. The rights have been violated. It's now time for revolution. And then the most influential thing that most of the founders didn't actually believe but was everywhere in the colonies is going to be Protestantism, right?
Yeah.
That's going to be the number one influence, even though if randomly selected founding father showed up at your evangelical church on a Sunday morning, you would let him attend the service but not join because he doesn't believe most of the stuff that's being preached.
Don't let him teach Sunday school.
Definitely not. Definitely not going to do that. So all of those kind of come together in this one document. You can see the echoes of all of those different streams of thought running through the whole thing. So that's what I use it for. I used to assign it. I used to have students read the whole thing. I've dropped that just because they don't. Even this year, I'm in my summer class. We are reading it out loud, but we're only doing it a couple of lines at a time because it's just interminable if you don't do it that way.
Okay.
So at the beginning of every class,
I make my 11th graders read the whole thing.
Well, but do they actually do it?
I give them class time to do it, and also they have to answer questions immediately following. So yes, because they know
fair.
That there's chips on the table, they do it.
Fair enough. So yeah, I have a friend who's involved in city government that they, in their city meetings, decided earlier this year they were going to read the document at the beginning of a staff meeting, and they did not get very far before the guy reading said, "You know what? I think we got the gist of it."
And it probably didn't happen, but I hope they jumped to the end where they said, yeah, we're a country now.
Right. So I mentioned Protestantism at the end there. What do you do with the religious stuff in it, Nathan? You're the trained minister, the trained and ordained. I don't know if that's the right word to use of someone
ordained
in your tradition.
Is right.
But,
yes. All right. I am mainline clergy, so I'm one of those guys now. But
fair enough.
Yeah, it's interesting here because Jefferson does use the phrase nature's God. And of course, he uses the word creator. Of course, God is that, you know, Anglo-Saxon word that comes to translate the Latin Deus and the Greek Theos. And, you know, creator is, you know, a very Latinate word. So, I mean, you know, he's using, you know, words that the Protestant readers of North America would recognize. And also the, you know, in various stages of Catholicism and post-Catholicism readers in Europe would recognize. But, I mean, you know, one of the things that's interesting about this is, you know, the writers of this, as Coyle mentioned, are not going to be believers in the sense that, you know, they confess to the things that, you know, folks confess to when they recite the Nicene Creed or the Apostles' Creed or so on and so forth in churches. So I'm always curious about this myself. And honestly, because I teach it in a public school context, we don't dwell on this a whole lot. You know, if a student brings it up, we will have a conversation about it, but I don't make it an express part of the lesson plan, so to speak. You know, one of the questions, and I'm always better with questions than I am with answers. One of the questions that occurs to me is when the same person who edited the Jefferson Bible, where you keep all of these sayings of Jesus, but you cut out all of the miracle narratives, when that is one of the five people and, you know, one of the more prominent five people involved with this document, and they use that word God and they use that word creator, what do they mean? And, you know, I think about Immanuel Kant, and I have no idea whether any of these guys would have even known who Immanuel Kant was at this time, because he hasn't really come to international prominence by 1776. That comes later on in his career. But when Kant talks about God, what he is talking about is a thought that people have that, you know, gives form to the ways that we talk about human responsibility and human knowledge and so on and so forth, but that can't be known in any serious sense. And when Kant talks about revelation, he talks about things that are in accord with human reason. So it's almost the opposite of what revelation meant in medieval theology, right? So this historical moment is fascinating to me precisely because these words are, as they always are, undergoing a transformation in how people use them, right? One of the interesting, and I have no idea why I'm jumping to this, but it occurred to me, so I'm going to say it out loud because that's how I work. But, you know, the fact that, you know, in public opinion research, you know, there is a small and I would say very small, but still interesting segment of survey respondents who answer yes to the question, are you Muslim? And also yes to the question, are you evangelical? You know, so I mean, you know, something is happening to the word evangelical, at least on the margins, that makes it a very different adjective and a very different noun than it was even within my lifetime, certainly different than it was during the lifetime of Martin Luther, right? So, I mean, here with, you know, the Declaration of Independence, I mean, God seems to be active here. You know, God seems to be a point of appeal here. So, I mean, it's not quite going as far as what Immanuel Kant is doing. But on the other hand, once again, you know, these are people who are not churchmen. Is it John Adams that, you know, or it was either Adams or Washington who would go to church and then he would leave just before the Eucharist because he thought that part was nonsense?
Well, I don't know. That sounds like a Washington. I mean, Adams was
I think it was Washington. So, you know, I mean, what occurs to me, Coyle, is there's kind of two extremes in 21st century rhetoric about the founding generation. One of them is America was just absolutely not a Christian nation. And then the other side of that is, well, I mean, look, they talk about Creator and God, so they must be Christians. And it seems to me that, you know, at minimum, we have to say that it is a complex of those things. And I would go even further to that and say that there's got to be some awareness on the part of these guys that these words mean different things to someone sitting in an Anglican church in Virginia than they do to someone who is in a Quaker meeting house in Pennsylvania. And those two guys probably aren't going to agree with, you know, someone who is, you know, doing whatever, you know, non-churchgoers do in, let's put, New Hampshire. Well, yeah, what do you have to say? Because I'm running in circles.
Well, I think you're sort of on it. I mean, I think by using Creator, you use a word that basically only a handful of people are going to object to at the time.
Yeah,
opens it up to people of all faiths. We're all faiths. Okay. And the colonies at this point means everyone from, you know, Baptists to Anglicans, with the occasional Roman Catholic maybe thrown in. You know, Charles Carroll is there.
You do have Maryland.
It's true. There are a handful of atheists too. Thomas Paine and Ethan Allen are both floating around and doing their thing also. But by and large, that Creator word is vague enough. It's not going to offend anyone, and specific enough that it's going to actually mean something. And I don't know if it means more than that, but I think there's that's maybe the rhetorical element of using that. They did not say Jesus, and they did not say,
they certainly did not. Yeah,
and they did not cut the Creator out completely. So it. Again, I'm assuming that there's just a practical wisdom in play in choosing that.
Right, right. And again, I mean, you know, this is where, you know, the history of rhetoric is always fascinating to me because, you know, I mean, even as recently as Joe Biden, you know, presidents, you know, end their formal addresses in front of television cameras with God bless America. Right. So, I mean, you know, that noun is still part of an, you know, invocation style sentence at the end of a public address, even in a moment where it is customary for public officials to say people of any faith and people of no faith, right? Yep. The last thing that I would say about the divine rhetoric here is that one of the things that these public figures are dealing with, and that, you know, public figures in the United States have dealt with ever since, is that variety in worship and non-worship. So one of the things that I think I was probably a lot more judgmental about when I was in my 20s that I have mellowed on now that I'm coming up on 50 is that, you know, when you do talk to groups of people with differing notions of the divine, it's not necessarily hypocrisy and it's not necessarily duplicity to use rhetoric that they all will find satisfying. Now, it can be those things. I'm not going to deny that it can be, but this might just be that I'm getting mellow with age. But I'm not nearly as mad about it as I used to be.
No, that's fair. And I think a lot of that depends on both what you're trying to say and the context and the audience, right? So if I were addressing a group of mixed religions, you know, if we had Protestants and Roman Catholics and Muslims all in one room, I would have no problem whatsoever just saying God and leaving it open. If I'm talking about, you know, my areas of research or American history or whatever. Now, if I'm trying to evangelize the room or if I'm trying to witness, then that might be different.
Well, yeah,
but
yeah.
This is not an evangelistic document, right? This is not.
That makes good sense. That makes good sense.
And the guy to read on this is Mark David Hall, right? His he has written extensively on religion and the American founding, and done so from a fairly sane perspective. I think that's probably the... That makes it sound like everyone else is insane, and that's not entirely true either, but he's got a fairly balanced and nuanced approach. I'm blanking on the name of his book off the top of my head, but it's my go-to for I want to say he's at a Regent now. Used to be at George Fox University, and now
okay.
he's at Regent.
Okay, very good, very good. Well, Coyle, one last thing, and this is just a little bit of a, you know, declaration of independence, 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon, is that, you know, when I was prepping for today's episode, I discovered that the three Georgia signatories of the Declaration of Independence, all of the counties named after them are adjacent to the county where I live. So I have actually substitute taught back when I was a grad student, and sometimes I had as many as 4 side jobs. I have substitute taught in all 3 of the counties named after Declaration of Independence signatories in Georgia. So
there you go.
And of course, one of those is Button Gwinnett, you know, whose Northern high school I now teach at. So there you go.
Fair enough.
Well, Coyle, you know, next time I'm going to pitch an idea to you, and you're going to tell me why it's not only a dumb idea, but also unconstitutional, and okay. that is Swing State University. And I'm going to leave it right there, let the listeners wonder what the heck I'm talking about, let you wonder what the heck I'm talking about.
I'm wondering what you're talking about.
And we'll talk about it next episode. So,
sounds good.
In the meantime, listeners, thank you for downloading and listening in to the City of Man podcast. City of Man is part of the Christian Humanist Radio Network. With the help of AI, we do our own editing right now, but you should listen in to our fellow shows, Christian Humanist Profile, and Before They Were Live, and tell your friends about us. We are slowly but surely making our comeback into the world of podcasting, and we always appreciate when you all chime in and tell us what you think about our episodes. You can find us on Facebook. I am hoping sometime this summer to start up an Instagram account for the network. And of course, you can email us at thechristianhumanist@gmail.com, and I will try to answer that email when we do get it. In the meantime, I'm Nathan Gilmore. This is Coyle Neal, and thank you for listening to the City of Man podcast.
This land is your land, and this land is my land, from the California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me. As I went a-walking that ribbon of highway.